This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hero Bread. Burger buns, tortillas, and fluffy breads, and oh, so many carbs. Hero Bread makes healthier versions of these carb favorites. Fewer calories, 0 to 2 grams net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, great taste. With more of the dietary fiber and protein you want with no compromise. Don't skip out on your favorites. Just use Hero Bread. Get 10% off your order at hero.co with code HEROPOD at checkout. That's HEROPOD at HERO.CO.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. So we haven't established a link between comedy and national security, but maybe there is one. Did you know Wanda Sykes worked for the NSA before she went into stand-up? What other comedians might be privy to government secrets?
What if Bob Hope? What if he were like a super spy? You know, think about all the countries he got to go to and places he performed. What if he was real? The whole comedian thing was a ruse and he was really a spy.
I mean, that is really putting in some work on your cover. Like, if you're Bob Hope.
Yeah, but think about it. The comedy really wasn't that sharp. So maybe he was doing
like the reason.
Like, how is this guy this famous?
I think if you're my generation, you grew up wondering why people liked Bob Hope.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, oh, it was a government sponsored initiative.
Yes. All propaganda.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to Wanda Sykes about stand-up comedy race coming out. And her character, Biggie Shorty, a standout role in one of the greatest films ever made.
Just likes to stand on the corner.
Yeah.
And, you know, dress fancy. Hang out with the whores. That's just her thing.
But first, I'll talk to another fantastic comedian, Maria Bamford. Her new Netflix show, Lady Dynamite, finds humor in her own struggles with mental illness. She's doing better now, but she says her medication has its drawbacks.
Some of the medications I'm on allow for sleep at night, and that really shut down some of my productivity. I was doing a lot of vacuuming and writing at night. No more!
Plus, I'll tell you about an indie rock band too enigmatic to do interviews, so if you haven't heard of Black Moth Super Rainbow, that might be why. All that coming up this week on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. In Maria Bamford's new show, Lady Dynamite, she plays herself at a few points in her relatively recent life. As a successful comic, trying to find love and show business stability in Los Angeles, as a harried member of a loving but very unusual family while in outpatient therapy in Duluth, Minnesota, and in a mental institution being treated for bipolar disorder. All of these are based on Maria's real life. The tone isn't grim and raw, like you might expect from a show like this. Just like Maria's stand-up, it's fun and it's unpredictably surreal. Here's a scene from Lady Dynamite. Maria's talking with her manager, Bruce. She's just finished her outpatient treatment. Bruce is played by Fred Malamud. Their meeting is interrupted at the end by a call.
Now that you're back in town, you tell me exactly what you want to do. TV show, movie, world comedy tour, and I'm going to take a real shot at getting it for you.
Yeah.
Chantrell, get me the hidden big opportunities list, would you?
Okay, I would like to do less, not more. That's the thing. I'm going to be less ambitious, or maybe not ambitious anymore.
Less ambitious, No work for Maria.
I mean, I want to work a little, but just smaller things, less pressure. Maybe stand up at a bookstore or alone in my living room or at a vintage eyeglass shop. Or...
Look, sweetheart, you're not pulling back because of me, are you? Because I can reel in that big fish. I mean, I can land the monster shark. Believe me, you've seen the desk.
No, no, this is not about you at all. I'm just trying to get some balance in my life. I know I've done some things I regret, and I made some enemies, I'm sure, from some of my behavior, and I'd like to make that...
Mark Sugar Ray McGrath.
Okay, what? The singer?
Don't listen to her. She's useless.
Maria Bamford, welcome back to Bullseye. It's good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was a real thing in your life, that you went to your management and asked to have less career.
Yes, that is true. Yeah, I don't know if you've read the writer Tom Hodgkinson's. He's a British humorist, some might say philosopher, who talks about the art of being idle, and that it's an environmental cause to do less, to loaf, and that's what we're doing in our family, is just more of that. I genuinely can't do as much as I used to, and some of the medications I'm on allow for sleep at night, and that really shut down some of my productivity. I was doing a lot of vacuuming and writing at night. No more.
But, I mean, look, I've met your manager, whose real life name is Bruce.
Bruce.
And he's a very nice man, especially for a show business guy.
Yes.
But it still takes some courage and good reasons to go into your manager's office and say, I want less.
Yes. I am the king of no. I'm like... I don't. Yeah, it is. But the thing is, then the things that you do, you enjoy them so much more. And I think, at least, especially in the entertainment industry, but maybe in every industry now, because we're all self-employed, there is the feast or famine thing. Like, oh, well, I got to take it now. I got to do it now. I've heard many of my friends say, I'm in my prime earning years. Oh, geez. What? Oh, God. So there's that panic for me. And so I think I'm trying to just live within my means, yet my means do not define me. I can live – I can enjoy a taco, which is very inexpensive in my neighborhood. And then – so it's okay. I don't have to make as much money.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to comedian Maria Bamford. Her new, somewhat autobiographical sitcom is called Lady Dynamite. It launches on Netflix this week. When you were younger and you were manic, did you come up with plans?
No. I was hypomanic, so I didn't have a psychosis or that part does run in my family, so I am that's why I want to stay on meds, because I'm in danger of doing that. I would get very obsessed if I had OCD.
When I say plans, I don't mean...
Plans of suicide?
No, I just mean plans in a broader sense. Because I think that's something that,
yes,
that often manic people, you know, the idea of valuing relationships and quiet time does not come naturally to someone,
right,
who's manic.
Yes, I wanted to, I think I came out to Los Angeles. I thought, oh, I want to have a TV show. I want to be extremely successful and et cetera, et cetera. But also my brain was also fighting me on that, because I did have depression. It was, relatively terrible. So I was sort of an energized depressive, like having just enough energy to hurt myself. And so, yeah, I definitely had more grandiose visions. I'm not grandiose, but once it became an option to start working constantly, like, oh, you can tour the world. I did the Edinburgh Festival 3 times and
did, you know, could have gotten a European agent. Oh, you could do Hong Kong. What? Then just more and more. And you can really become extremely productive. And that I just kept feeling worse and worse. That led for me to a breakdown. Now, other people I know love it. Like, they're extroverted. They love, I think of somebody like Kathy Griffin. I mean, she loves touring, from what I can tell and from what I've heard her say is, you know, she enjoys being on the road and work itself. And so I feel super ashamed. It's been very embarrassing to not be as productive as I feel like I once was. But oh well.
But what kind of – but I can't imagine that what you're characterizing as productivity was ultimately very productive for you.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the question. Like, you go, oh, well, was I, you know, spending 2 months touring on Australia? Was that helpful? Like, was it – because I was slightly miserable, but was that, you know – did I become a better stand-up? Because it is a real mixed blessing. You know, I remember I did Vegas for a couple of weeks, and it was miserable. I did terribly, but I did get used to doing a half hour of material in front of people who were not enjoying it, and I just got used to doing my time, which was extremely useful. And that was one of the only places I could do it, which is one – Vegas provides – is such a generous city in that it just provides a space, especially at least for comics. Like, I felt like I got one TV credit and I was allowed to be a middle up there. I felt like I was paid reasonably well. I think it was $700 a week to – go up and I really bombed and I was not fired, and I'm grateful. Thank you, Harrah's.
So what where were you at when you ended up having the breakdown a few years ago?
Well, it was just kind of a slow burn where I was trying to handle it. You know, I was like, okay, I am not feeling well in a whole new way, like in a way that is really bad. And I went to a new psychiatrist and they said, you are genuinely starting to talk too fast. I think you need to be on a mood stabilizer. And I felt very offended by that and thought, well, that's dumb and I don't agree with it. But then I kept feeling really terrible. And then I told a friend of mine, hey, if you think I'm talking too fast, you tell me. And I'll go into some place for 72 hours and I'll go on one of those mood stabilizers. So I did that. My friend did that. She was like, yeah. And my friend Amy, and she drove me to Las Encinas. I don't recommend it.
This is a real like Yelp profile of recommendations. And
it was not good. I don't think it was as a result of any of the employees, but I think it was just I wouldn't say dirty. Let's say extremely worn, and then there's Ultimate Fighting playing on a giant screen TV, and half puzzles. Have you ever seen a puzzle that's a half puzzle where half the pieces are gone? And just throw out the puzzle. Toss the puzzle.
You're really just describing like a kind of like an obstacle course for mental wellness.
Exactly. Well, and some of the things, which this is terrible, but they said, okay, so on one of the walls, they had this schedule for health and wellness. So on the wall was like this fake fantasy schedule of like, oh, we do stretching at 9 and then we talk to each other at 10 and then sing song along. None of it happened. It did not exist. And that was even more like crazy making, like,
oh, I guess we're not being good enough. We don't get to do there's no marshmallows around the campfire tonight. Because it's just...
And that was where the psychiatrist Googled me during the session. Because I told him by mistake, I said I was a comedian. And he said he had to YouTube me because he was concerned I might be delusional. Oh, my God. I mean, if I had said I was Richard Pryor, certainly. Certainly. But at least have the courtesy.
It is a real job.
Have the courtesy to IMDb me when I've left the room.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This is Bullseye. My guest is Maria Bamford. Her new comedy show, Lady Dynamite, launches on Netflix this week. One of the things someone close to me was institutionalized briefly, and one of the things that I heard is a kind of feeling like the levels of mental crisis vary widely among the people that are in the institution,
yes,
from folks who are there very temporarily to folks who are there less temporarily, and you know, folks with all different kinds of conditions. And one of the most difficult things is that, you know, both the kind of levels and the kinds of mental competency just are all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're just never sure where the other people are at.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel like you're not sure where you're at too.
Yeah. No, and I wasn't there at all. Like, I feel like at that point, every moment of consciousness had become unbearable. Like, I was just – I could not get any – except when I was sleeping, I just was I can't really even explain it. I guess it must be like physical pain when you feel something. It just was psychiatric. I now understand why people kill themselves, like to end the agony of it. So I was there at this hospital for 3 days, and they put me on a mood stabilizer whose primary side effects were of course I can't remember the word for it. Primary.
Thanks to the primary side effects of your current
stabilizer. It's our cognitive. They're right. Cognitive. Making it difficult to think or talk. And then I went back out on the road almost immediately and ended up in Chicago. And I was just totally confused. I it was like 2 hours before showtime, and I'd lost all my identification. And I was like bleeding. I'd cut myself on the cab. And I had tried telling my jokes to myself, and they weren't coming out. So I canceled about 6 shows at the last minute and then went back in again. But I went to the Glendale Adventist Medical Center, and also not fun. They got a little cement courtyard in there where you can walk around an orange cigarette bucket.
It's called a pop of color.
It's called a pop of, exactly. And their outpatient program is very good, actually. I did appreciate that. I mean, also, it's like you're feeling terrible, so nothing's going to be that great. And then I went in there another time just because I was just trying to get stabilized. I kept feeling like, I got it, you know, and then trying to go back to work and then going, oh, no, I don't. You know, feeling scared to be by myself in a hotel room or whatever.
Was there something that changed, or and if something changed, was it as gradual as the things that changed that led you to that point, or was it more of a realization?
I think it was definitely medication-oriented. Like, I have never felt this good in my life of feeling like sort of even keel, where I can – it's been since like 2011 that I've been on – I'm on Depakote and Seroquel and Prozac, and I
it's just sort of a way where I feel like, yeah, I don't have those rushes of energy and productivity. And now I totally understand. Like, I used to not have any compassion for people who would say, I just can't get things done. I'd be like, you jackass. Like, I'd just be so irritable with people like who could not get things done. I'd be like, and now I understand that. I go, oh, yeah, I lost focus and I got tired. And so I don't know if that's good or bad, but I do feel genuinely happier, I think, and I'm having a fuller life experience. And yeah, but I think it was definitely medication oriented. And then starting to reconnect with friends, reconnect with the world, and seeing that it was okay, that nobody cared or nobody noticed and, you know, it didn't matter.
Do you feel like you got some of the opposite of that?
Yes, exactly. I got the total opposite of that. People who I had no idea about, you know, took me to lunch and said, I saw snakes, and then I was in a psychiatric hospital for, you know, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is so awesome. Don't tell me more about the snakes, you know. And so it's just and it gives me solace knowing, too, that if something like that would happen again, that I'd be okay. My mom had a episode in her 60s, and oh, goodness. the outcome, which is now she has $15,000 in a savings account that's just for her, just in case she wants to stay at a nice hotel when she's manic. She and my dad have an arrangement. But she's also staying on her meds.
it's a dual front attack.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, I haven't had I guess I've had a little bit of the money thing, but I get more obsessed with ethical or moral quandaries. One of the storylines in the show is that I'm anxious about working for this giant corporation as a commercial, and that is exactly what happened with Target. I started getting
You had done for a few years a series of holiday commercials for Target.
Yes.
Where you played a kind of semi-satirical savings mad shopper.
Savings mad shopper, and which was super fun to play. But then all of a sudden, and not all of a sudden, I've always felt that people should be paid a living wage. But once realizing, oh, it's maybe this is bad, what I'm, you know, trying to tell people to shop, accumulate, the workers overseas are not being paid a living wage. It's affecting the environment, however, because they don't have any regulations of how to, you know, so, yeah. So I started to get really wigged out about that. And, yeah, I went to a priest. And then I think it was part their choice to end the campaign. Maybe they could tell I was going banunu. But for whatever reason, because I remember the last thing I did for Target, I think my hair was falling out. Like, I was really stressed. And so, and I remember just feeling really mixed about it, that, yeah, it was a fun character, but it was also a very lonely character. She was by herself, just shopping. And when I went to the manager's conference once a year they have a manager's conference. And, you know, I think Target is a wonderful company, and I shop there, and I think they do a lot of great things. But one of the things I noticed is that they showed all the employees in the U.S. and how well they're treated. And, you know, I don't know if that's totally true because I've heard differently that people are there's union busting there and people are kept at part time, et cetera. And that I think was also hard for me as a comedian to go, oh, and I can't talk about it. I'm under agreement to not talk about it. And that felt terrible. But I was starting to get so obsessed with it, I just thought, I'm going to crash and burn and say something really bizarre, you know, in front of, or, you know, and do something hurtful to a giant corporation that, And really, it would be to myself, too, because I'm sure they wouldn't change. I'm sure I don't know. I'm not sure if they would change their...
Hello, CEO of Target.
Yeah, exactly.
I have Maria Bamford here.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Well, there's that story in the Bible, Esther. You know the story of Esther?
What happens to Esther?
Esther is a Jew, and they have a big beauty contest, and the king chooses her as his wife. Then his terrible executive director says, oh, guess what? You know what I think is a great idea? Let's kill all the Jews. Esther hadn't told him that she was a Jew, and so was her whole family. Whoops. She makes this meal for him, like a whole banquet, has a big party, and then is going to tell him she can't do it. Makes a whole meal, has a big party for him, can't do it. Then finally gets up the courage at the third party, rule of three, and then she tells him, and then he goes, oh, my God, I will not kill the Jews, and I will not do that, and I'm going to actually kill this executive director guy. I want to say his name was Hammond, but I'd be wrong about that. So I did do the Target ad for 3 years. I never got the courage to take Oprah aside and say, Ope, you know how you advocate for this company? Did you realize, like during the manager's thing, they had this incredible just – like all these, they had Tony Bennett, James Taylor, Taylor Swift, Beyonce, Oprah, like incredible artists, everyone performing. Then they had this recognition of all the employees at Target and, you know, a few abroad in India who do the computer stuff. And then no mention of how it's distributed or how it gets there or how it's made. Just no mention. Where do all these magical objects come from? I just thought that was so funny. And anyways, but I didn't want to get sued, nor did I want to – like it was a funny idea that brought people a lot of joy. So I didn't want to harsh anybody's mellow.
And it's a great place to get – I've found especially plastic storage bins.
It really is. That and LaCroix water.
Oh, yeah. The sparkling water comes in all the flavors.
All the types.
So many flavors. And especially like the limited flavors or the new flavors.
Also, aesthetically, it's an attainable museum. Like, I had a friend, her dad died, and they all went to Target afterward because they just want to cheer themselves up and see things in a... in colors that are, you know, in a way that where it's like, I mean, that takes skill and planning. And no, I love a Target. I am, please still let me in.
My guest Maria Bamford has a new Netflix show called Lady Dynamite. It's about her life as a comedian and her previous life with her family while undergoing outpatient psychiatric care and in a mental institution. And I want to play another scene from the show. So your character, Maria, has this assistant, who's barely an assistant, and she pressures you into going on a date.
Yes.
And the person on the date is a former meth addict.
Yes.
And avowed bisexual named Shane. He turns out to be very handsome.
Which the legal department had asked me, oh, is there, you know, one person we got to make sure? And I'm like, no, I've dated two bisexual meth addicts. So we're covered.
they go on this one date and it goes really nicely. And he's very handsome, and they find a lot of parallels between their personal struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And then this scene is in a restaurant where they've gone for dinner, and the restaurant is called A Serious Scene.
I was almost in a serious scene on West Wing, but I got fired.
Well, I know that feeling. When I was jacked on meth, I got fired all the time. I almost killed Rob Reiner twice while doing squat spots. FYI, you cannot lift a 375-pound man on meth. I'm not being fair. That was a good week for him. It was more like 349. But for all the bad stuff, you know what's weird? I miss the meth.
That's not weird at all. I miss the energy of mania. I may have been contemplating suicide 18 hours a day, but my baseboards were spotless.
You know what I don't miss about meth is waking up with some strange man in my bed.
It's funny because I get in trouble if I don't take my meds, but you get in trouble if you do.
So stupid.
I think one of the interesting things about the last, I mean, look, you've had a very colorful last few years of your life, but one of the many colors in that palette is that you started dating and eventually married your husband.
Yes.
Whose name is Scott, and he's
Scott Marvel Cassidy.
And he's a really lovely guy.
He is.
Before you met him, did you feel like you were going to find someone to share your life with?
Well, I've always dated along. You know, I went on at least 100 internet dates. I'm willing to try. And and then I had tried to have relationships, you know, lasted about a year. And a lot of times, I don't think I had the wherewithal to calm down and commit to something. Like, because it does take a time, relationships do, it turns out, friendships. And if you care about somebody, you have to sit there and listen every once in a while. And I wasn't as good at that. And, so I think in the past few years, for sure, I've become, and I think part of it because of the health crisis thing, just feeling like, oh, there's no time to wait. And I don't have to be perfect to be loved and love someone. And I think I definitely got that from that experience of like, you know, people love me or seeing also people in the hospital, like they had husbands and wives and children and they were living lives and they went through a health crisis and then they went back out and I was like, oh, like some, well, I guess I've always thought I had to achieve something until I was ready to have a wonderful, loving experience. And not that it's, I mean, I also want to say that it's, relationships do not come naturally to me. My first instinct is to, I mean, there's, yeah, me moving to California from Minnesota was for also because I'm not, you know, wasn't very good with my family. I think I do impersonations with my family so I can better feel like I'm connected to them. I don't know. You know, there's, I think, I'm just grateful, is what I'm trying to say, that I can have a nice relationship.
I don't know if it's because I have largely met your husband when he's been with you and you've been doing professional stuff, like right. Coming to do a podcast or going to do an event. But he seems to have a really lovely, peaceful quality to him.
Yes, yes. He is. I mean, he has his own nervous Nellies. He's a calming effect on me. And yeah, he's a good dude, and he loves to paint. And I think it's nice. Like we can relate to each other as artists, and he loves the dogs. I always like old pugs, and he's totally on board with an old pug. And, it's just been super, I feel so grateful and exciting. It's as I think I say in the first episode, it's a late in life opportunity. What a boon.
I'll continue my conversation with one of my absolute favorite comedians, Maria Bamford, after a break. We'll talk about the recent successes in her personal and professional lives. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for Bullseye and the following message come from The Black Tux, a modern way to rent tuxedos and suits. The Black Tux designs and manufactures handsome suits and tuxedos for rent fast and easy online. You can select from complete looks or build your own. And the Black Tux customer service team is on hand to lend assistance with fitting needs. Shipping's free both ways, so after an event, use the box the tuxedo or suit came in to send it back. Visit theblacktux.com/bullseye. Experience a new way to rent. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Try out the NPR One app for your phone for conversations you won't hear anywhere else. This week, find Guy Raz's exclusive interview with TED curator Chris Anderson, where they discuss the TED phenomenon and the secret to giving a great TED talk. Find their conversation by searching TED Radio on the NPR One app, where you can also find stories from your local station and more great podcasts. NPR One is on your app store now. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the brilliant comedian Maria Bamford. Her new TV show, Lady Dynamite, launches on Netflix this week. Maria, you're someone who, by personality, often thinks a lot about their responsibilities towards the world and towards others, sometimes ahead of yourself. And as we've heard to some extent in this conversation, and I wonder if you've been able to enjoy the fact that, you know, you've been doing this pretty difficult form of comedy. I mean, both difficult to execute and difficult to appreciate. That sounds like an insult, but I mean it in the absolute best way. No. It's like a literary novel of comedy.
Oh, that's wonderful. No, I appreciate that. That's wonderful.
And you have, you know, especially in the last—
I keep trying to read it. I keep trying to like it.
Especially in the last 5 or 8 years, you've really come to be very successful and, like, you know, change people's lives with your art and be appreciated and stuff. And I wonder if you're able to process that and appreciate it without thinking about all the things that might be wrong with it or that you should be doing more
Yes, I do. I'm super psyched. Feel useful in society and feel like more connected with the world. But the stand-up thing, saying that that's more difficult than any other job in life, I don't think it's true. It's to show up to a 9-to-5 job takes an enormous amount of emotional, spiritual, mental chutzpah. Like I did secretarial work and, you know, that was not my passion, but to be there and to be pleasant for 8 hours at a time, anybody who's doing that or manual labor or, you know, people are holding down 3 jobs at once, that stand-up is a breeze, like especially for me now. Oh, my God. With the internet, is just – it makes it so easy to find your people, you know. So it's like I'm almost, just very rarely put in a place where I would be ever heckled or – but I don't know if that's a bad thing or a good thing, but it definitely takes the fright factor out of it. Like I don't have to do the long shows of, you know, Wednesday through Sunday and just 7 shows and second show Friday where nobody knows what they've come to see and all the shows are – you have to go back to all your old material because it's like, oh, God, nobody likes anything, you know. I don't have to do those shows anymore. I fly in on a Tuesday, see only my friends, my people who are all pumped, and then go home. So it I would say it's a delightful and an ease on many, many levels. Comparatively with other jobs that I've had. I've had food service jobs, and oh, my God, that is – I would have nightmares before waitressing for years.
So you're able to be happy even though you don't have the most unpleasant job in the world? Is that what you're telling
me? That's what I'm trying to say. I know. I'm my father's daughter. My dad, what did he say? He said one of his favorite quotes is, don't be humble. You're not that great. By Bella Abzug, if you're wondering.
Well, Maria, I'm always grateful to get to spend time with you. So thank you so much for coming. And thanks for your great new show and your amazing work.
Oh, yay. Thank you so much, Jesse. Thank you for having me on. I listen to the show on KPCC here in Los Angeles.
Maria Bamford's new show, Lady Dynamite, launches on Netflix this week. My next guest on Bullseye is another world-class comedian. Wanda Sykes won an Emmy for her writing on The Chris Rock Show. She's also earned accolades for her stand-up and for her work as an actor. You might have seen her on Black-ish, The New Adventures of Old Christine, and Curb Your Enthusiasm. Sykes is performing two shows at the Theater at the Ace Hotel in Los Angeles this Saturday, May 21st. The shows will be filmed for her epic special out later this year. It's called What Happened, Miss Sykes? Here's a clip from her 2009 special, I'ma Be Me.
Isn't it funny that the only time your race or gender is questioned is when you're not a white man? I think white men, they get upset, they get nervous, like a minority or another race gets a little power. It makes them nervous because they scared that race is going to do to them what they did to that race. They get nervous. So they start screaming, reverse racism. This is reverse racism. I'm like, wait a minute, in reverse racism, isn't that when a racist is nice to somebody else? Isn't that to other people? That's reverse racism. Like, what you're afraid of is called karma.
Wanda Sykes, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
As we were playing that clip, you got this far-off look in your eye, like you were just visiting yourself from another time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I do that. It's hard to listen, you know. Well, I guess it's not hard, but I go back and I'm like, wow, that was really good, you know. And it's like, whew, that was solid. Okay. And I, you know, you always want to do better. You want to, you know, beat yourself. So,
I feel like the gold standard for listening back to yourself on this show was one of the Pointer Sisters was in here, and she just fully started singing along with herself.
Oh, wow.
Just 100% no shame. Just like, yeah, this is a great song. Uh-huh. I'm going to sing right now.
Uh-huh. That's awesome. I wish I could do that. Sing, I mean.
Live without shame.
Yes. Just sing. Yeah.
If you had to live without shame, it might be hard to be a stand-up comedian.
You have to have some shame to be a stand-up comic. I think that's up top. That's like in the top three, I think. Yeah.
So you grew up in Virginia. What kind of Virginia did you grow up in?
Country Virginia. In the woods. I mean, I would say woods, but very rural and very segregated. I was the first, but I remember being in second grade, and my teacher was calling the roll. And then when she got to me, you know, I was only, you know, black kid in the class. She was like, Wanda Sykes. And I raised my hand. She said, oh, my God, I'm just so thrilled. You're the first colored girl I ever get to teach. I'm like, you're the first colored girl. Yeah. And I thought it was like an honor. I'm like, well, yes, ma'am. I'm your first. And not realizing how horrible that was. But yeah, she was so excited that she got to teach a little colored girl.
You were a grown up when you started your career, right?
Yes. I was a grown up. I had benefits and, you know, a good job and everything. I was working for the National Security Agency. So yeah, I had a career.
As an international super spy?
I so wish it could have been that interesting. That would have been awesome. That'd have been awesome. But no. I was just basically buying things. I was a contracting specialist.
I think the problem is that if you had been an international super spy, even if you became a comic, that's automatically your hook. And it's real limiting to be the super spy comic. Because there's not a lot you're allowed to talk about.
You know what? Yeah, it is. But just think about it, though. Because, like, comics, like, what if Bob Hope, what if he were like a super spy? You know, think about all the countries he got to go to and places he performed. What if he was real? The whole comedian thing was a ruse, and he was really a spy.
I mean, that is really putting in some work on your cover. Like, if you're Bob Hope, like, because Bob Hope was out there.
Right.
You know, he was hitting the boards at 85.
Yeah, but think about it. The comedy really wasn't that sharp. So maybe he was doing
like the reason. Like,
how is this guy this famous?
I think if you're my generation, you grew up wondering why people liked Bob Hope.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, oh, it was a government sponsored initiative.
Yes. All propaganda.
You grew up in a military family, right?
Yes.
How was it the kind of military family that I imagine when I imagine a military family, like everybody is really serious and you have to do things in a specific way or that kind of thing?
No. We were so not that family that my father, he never wanted us to live on base. We always lived off base. And I think that was good. He looked at it as the military, that was his job, and so he went to the military base and did his job, and he would come home, and we had, regular household.
Was he always around? You were born in the mid-60s. Was he ever overseas or elsewhere?
He had some, times where he went away, but it wasn't for, an extended period of time where we had to travel with him. We were pretty, I don't know. I mean, I look at other friends who, are military families and, they're off to Germany and Japan and, all these, Korea, all these crazy places. And we pretty much went from Virginia to Maryland and that was it. My dad did the rest of the traveling. But like I said, the most 6 months was the longest I remember him going away.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the comedian and actor Wanda Sykes. She's performing live tour dates this spring and summer, and she'll be recording a new stand-up special this weekend in Los Angeles. Living in the sort of general D.C. area where everybody works for the government and coming from military family, was there an expectation that you would just have the kind of job that you get and you accrue seniority points and you get benefits and you are, stable for the rest of your life?
Well, that's the way it should have, played out, that I was on that path of this is your career. And then I could have actually looked at the date that I, could retire. And I just couldn't do it. I stayed there for about, I think I worked at NSA for about 5 years, 5-6 years. And I was moving up. I was getting my promotions, when they were expected. I just knew it just was not what I was supposed to be doing.
Why not?
I just wasn't into it. I'm a pretty passionate person, and the first few years I was into it, and then I was like, I don't like this. I don't even want to do it anymore. And I'm no longer on top of things the way I should be. I knew I was doing a crappy job, and I was like, I got to get out of here because this isn't the place where you should be slacking off, and also I would look at my time card, and if I saw I had accumulated 4 hours of leave, I would take it right then. I would go, hey guys, I'm out.
You're using your vacation days to go to the movies.
Yes, I would have to leave. I gotta get out of here.
What was it like the first time you went on stage?
It was magical. It really was. I had no idea what I was about to subject myself to. I hadn't been to a comedy club, so I hadn't seen, what things look like when they go wrong.
Were you a comedy fan? I mean, did you have comedy records that you were listening to?
Yeah, 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 all that stuff. But I just never, had made it into a comedy club.
Sometimes
never saw it live.
They're
just
the worst.
Just on TV. So. Yeah. So I got on stage and I was so loose and had my material and I killed. I did great. And I was like, this is it. This is exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. This is it.
You're really bold on stage. And I know some comics who are as bold in life as they are on stage. You know, I know outspoken comics who will just, you're just walking down the street and they'll tell you what they think.
Mm-hmm.
I think I probably know more bold comics who are very different on stage than they are in their life. And being on stage is kind of like is kind of like, in some ways, their ideal version of themselves, or at least their most performative version of themselves. Mm-hmm. Which one is the case for you?
I'm bold on stage. Off stage, I kind of, I want to say play by the rules, but I, you know, if I have a seat number, if I go to an event and this is my seat number, I have to sit in that seat. You know, I'm not the one that, you know, friends like, oh, look, there's some seats down there. Let's go sit down there. We're, you know, get a better seat. I'm like, oh, no. I have to, unless someone from the venue comes and tells me, hey, come down here, I will stay in my seat.
What do you do if somebody's in your seat?
I do ask them. I'd say, hey, man, you know, in my seat, you know.
One time I was at a concert with my mom. It was a rap concert, and my mom was probably 60 years old at the time. And
what in the world are you doing with your mom, 60 years old?
My mom likes rap music. I mean, she's not like the number one rap fan in the world, but she likes it, she was happy to go with me.
Oh, that's cool.
And she fully almost got in a fight with a lady in front of me. Just full on, almost a fit. And my mom's pretty big and tough.
Uh-huh.
Like, I think this lady was maybe in her late 20s. And, like, I feel like my mom could have took that lady because this big, tall lady just came and stood in front of my mom or something. I can't even remember what happened. Uh-huh. I don't even know what was going down.
If the woman was, like, in her 20s and your mom's in her 60s, your mother would have whooped her butt. I'm telling you, your mom would have. It's like that old Richard Pryor joke. You know, I'm not going to let you build a reputation on me. You know, your mother had everything at stake. She's like, I'm not going to let some young girl beat my butt right now. No, I'm taking her down. Your mother, oh my God, your mother would have gave her such a beating. I'm telling you. And in front of her son, oh my gosh. That poor woman, she has no idea what she avoided that night. Your mother would have abused her.
At what point in your stage career did you feel like you were doing it right? Like you had found what you were supposed to be doing? Did it come right away or did it take a while?
It definitely took a while. Because before, you know, I always think all stand-up comics, I'm not saying all. I hate when I use words like that. But most stand-up comics, they start off as giving you their impression of what a stand-up comic is and what they do. You know, like, hey, I'm going to talk like this. Like, we all kind of like start out like Jerry Seinfeld, I think. And then it's not until that you get confident and you have a point of view. And because first it's about just getting the cadence and the construction of, okay, this is a joke, and I know how, if I say things this way, it's funny. And then once you get, like I said, the confidence and the point of view, then you can start revealing a little bit more of yourself. Because at first, if you bomb and you're just doing jokes, you can go, oh, people didn't like my jokes. But if you start showing some of yourself, then it gets serious. It's like, oh my God, they don't like me. You know, they don't think I'm funny. So it just takes a while. So once I got to the point where I'm doing jokes about me and this is just how I think and just putting it out there, that's when I was like, oh, this, okay, now I'm on the right path. This is what I wanted to do, you know, because the comics I love, that's all they did.
I'll finish my conversation with Wanda Sykes after a break. She'll tell me about her experiences coming out as gay at the age of 44. And I'll make sure we talk about one of my favorite comedy movies of all time, the name of which I have been advised by professional lawyers I cannot say on the radio. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Hey, we wanted to let you know that one of your favorite NPR podcasts is back. Invisibilia returns with Season 2 on June 17th. Invisibilia explores the invisible forces that shape human behavior, thoughts, emotions, assumptions, expectations. This season, Invisibilia goes to a prison, an oil rig, a McDonald's in Russia, and a beach in New Jersey to explore the invisible forces at play in our institutions, work, family, governments. You can catch up on season one of Invisibilia anytime and listen to the season two preview starting May 20th at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Please help to make Bullseye even better by taking a quick survey. Just go to npr.org/bullseye survey and tell us what you think. That's npr.org/bullseye survey. Thank you. Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Wanda Sykes. She'll record her new stand-up special this weekend. It comes out on Epics later this year. We have some comedy from HBO in 1997, 20 years ago now. this is Wanda talking about why she's hesitant to have kids.
I've been married for 5 years, man. 5 years. I love being married. I do. Like being married. 5 years, no kids yet. No kids. I don't know. Was it like, yeah, yeah. I don't know. It's like, once you have kids, that's a lifelong decision. You in for life, you know? Once you have kids, man, it's just you and the kids. You just got to look at them. And they look at you. And the kids, they know they own you. They know they have you. The kids, they just look at you like, you know what? I could hit her in the head with my Tonka truck. What's she going to do?
So did you at that time, do you think, love being married?
Back then? Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I did. I got married, so yeah. You know, but then again, I got divorced. So, I had good intentions.
Did you think of yourself as being gay?
Back then? No. Uh-uh.
How did you think of yourself?
A married straight woman.
Did you have misgivings about it? I guess what I'm asking is, do you feel like, was that about you not recognizing something in yourself, or was that about something changing in you, or, you know, something like that?
I think it was definitely about not recognizing something about myself. Yeah, totally that. Because, I mean, you know, all those things, maybe when I was a kid, you know, it was there, but with, you know, just upbringing, everything, you got to, you know, suppress that stuff.
Did you feel like
you don't have to. I'm just saying back then, that's what I had to do. So, and then, you know, I was like, okay, so yeah, okay, yeah, I'm into guys, and just started dating guys and all along. And yeah, and then, you know, get married and all. And but the problem was, is that those relationships, although, yeah, felt like I was in love and, you know, got married and everything. But the relationships, there's just a certain place that I could only go to. And after that, it's this, well, this is about it for me, you know. I know, like, just about everyone, every guy that I'd been with up to that point, they all said the same thing, that, you know, I just feel like that I could walk out the door right now and you wouldn't give a damn. And I would just think in my mind, I was like, you know what? He's kind of right. You know, like, I would be okay. I wouldn't miss a beat. I'd just keep it moving.
To what extent do you think that was about the fact that you were gay and you maybe just weren't as interested in romantic love with guys?
Right.
And how much was it about the fact that you were gay and kind of protecting something about yourself and couldn't, you know, had a hard time in a relationship having the kind of openness with yourself and your partner that you needed to have?
I think it was more of the not really aware of, you know, yeah, I guess it wasn't knowing, you know, and then, but it was like, okay, wait a minute, why does this keep happening? Why, you know, especially after, you know, I tried marriage and all, I'm okay, now, wait a minute, why do I keep repeating myself? What's going on? And it was, you know, talking to people, actually going to therapy, you know. I think like one night, you know, drinking, whatever, some girlfriends, And I probably tried to make a couple moves on, you know, a couple of the girls there. And it was like, whoa, where'd that come from? You know, and it's like, yeah, I probably should go talk to someone. And then that was after that. And it was like, oh, so that's what's going on. Okay. So I said, okay, well, let me try this. And then once I did, it just, again, like comedy. Oh, okay, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
I don't have, obviously, the greatest well of insight about this as a straight white dude myself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if part of the challenge of it, of like acknowledging and embracing that part of yourself, is that you're already a black female comic. And it's like, really, I'm going to open up a new front?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, do I need this too? Do you need another reason to hate me? Why, you know? Really? You're just going to go for the, just three strikes. All right, come on, let's do it. All right. Yeah. But yeah, I think, yeah, a lot of it was that too. I don't want to deal with this. I mean, not just with strangers, but then with the family. I do not want to have this conversation with my parents. I don't, yeah.
Do you feel like it affected your work either negatively previously or positively afterwards?
Previously, I think I alluded a couple times to the fact that, you know, that there could be some, you know, lesbian or at least that I was very supportive of the gay community. That was there. I would say before it probably was a hindrance. It was, you know, I was holding back, because the thing of being a really good comic is to just totally, you know, be vulnerable and expose yourself and you know, have no fear. So I think before, yeah, it was kind of like, you know, a little debilitating, but afterwards, man, it's just opened up, you know, everything. It's just like total freedom. I walk out there with just one purpose, and that's to, you know, do my best and make people laugh, and not having any other, you know, little fears or anything in the back of my head going, watch out, don't say that, you know. So, yeah.
I want to play some comedy from your special from 2003, mm-hmm. Tongue Untied.
Okay.
My guest is Wanda Sykes. So this is Wanda talking about a sitcom that was offered to her.
Got a show coming out, my own sitcom coming out, and you know, I'm really excited about it because it's an idea that I came up with, you know. And before you get to do a show that you want to do, you got to listen to all they bad ideas, and they had a lot of bad ideas. You know, my agent would call me and she's like, "Wanda, you don't even want to hear this." I was like, no, tell me, what is it? She's like, all right. They want you to play a maid. And you win the lottery. But you love working for this family so much. You continue to be their maid. I said, set it up. I want to meet these people. So I can slap that dumbass idea right out their head.
When you came out, it was almost accidental, right? Like, not that you figured that you would live the kind of life where you do your thing and people know that need to know, and it's just not a big part of your public identity.
I thought I would live my life like most people live their lives, like just normal. I didn't go there with an agenda to, hey, today is it, I'm going to come out.
You mean, yeah. Like, I interviewed Louis C.K. last week. I did not have a part where I said to him, right, when did you tell everyone you were straight and
right,
you were married to a woman?
Exactly. Yeah.
So what were the circumstances?
I was in Vegas, and I think I was playing at Planet Hollywood. And it was the National Day of Protest against the passage of Prop 8 here in California. So I said, okay, guys, come on, everybody, we're going to find out where the protest is here. Oh, it's at the gay and lesbian. Said, okay, let's go over there and, you know, we're going to be there for the rally. So we were there, and a couple of people, you know, recognized me and everything. So the woman who was the head of the Gay and Lesbian Center, she's given a speech, and she said, oh, you know, we have someone here with us, and she's been such a big supporter of the community, and we want to thank her. And I'm looking around. I'm like, is Drew Barrymore out here? Is it Pink Drew Barrymore? Who's out here? You know. And she said, so if she would come up and say a few words, that'd be great. And she goes, Wanda Sykes. And I'm like, oh. And then I was like, oh, okay, they think I'm a supporter of the community. They don't know I live in the community, you know. So I just, yeah, so I just went up and gave my speech. And next thing you know, before, you know, I get back to my hotel room, my phone is blowing up. And I was like, you know, we just saw you on CNN. I'm like, what? You know, and yeah. And I called my publicist. I was like, she was like, yep, you're out. Good. Great. I'm like, okay. And that was it.
Hey, it's Jesse breaking in here. So my guest on Bullseye, Wanda Sykes, is about to talk about a movie that she was in, written and directed by Louis C.K., produced by Chris Rock. It is one of my favorite movies of all time. The lawyers at NPR suggested to us that we should not say the name of this movie on the air because it could be confused for a vulgarity. We are going to leave it in here on the podcast, although it was bleeped on the radio. So congratulations to you. However, if you have kids who are quick with the free associations, then I would suggest that you know that before you listen to this segment where we are about to say the name of the movie. It rhymes with Schmooty Schmang. Here we go.
It must be a comfort to know that you can walk on stage and not feel like you are catching anyone on the wrong foot when you talk about anything about who you are. Mm-hmm. That you can just go up and be you.
Right.
And people, you know, people know what they're getting
mm-hmm.
as a comic.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, early on, though, I think a couple people didn't know. I think I did catch a couple people off guard because I, you know, do a show. And it was weird. I've kind of like garnered this audience that comes from, I mean, which I love. They've become fans from different shows, or you know, so there's a nice mixture. I have my Pootie Tang fans, you know, they're usually high. that I have, you know,
I happen to be yeah. straight at
Juana. I have you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and then just people who've been with me through stand up from the beginning. Chris Rock show, and so I have this beautiful group of fans. So when I was going up earlier, right after I came out, and I'm talking about, you know, being married, and I would see people get up and leave, like, oh, you guys didn't get the memo, I'm sorry, you know, sorry about that, whatever. And you know, say, oh, you're going so God won't send you to hell when you die, is that it? Oh, you know, God thinks I'm funny, but all right, you know, I'm not going to give you your money back, by the way. You know? But yeah.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up Pootie Tang because I've just been waiting for an opportunity to talk about it extensively.
Okay.
It's basically the, along with the film Babe Pig in the City, probably the most important thing on this program. Maybe a little bit of Wet Hot American Summer, but mostly it's just Pootie Tang talk on Bullseye.
Okay. All right.
Let's take a listen to my guest, Wanda Sykes, in Pootie Tang, which is like, if you've never seen Pootie Tang, first of all, you should watch Pootie Tang because it's great. But it's kind of like a surreal tribute to blaxploitation, the premise of which is that Pootie Tang, the titular character, is so cool he doesn't actually have to use words. And Biggie Shorty, Wanda Sykes' character, is a streetwalker who is has a similar level of self-possession and coolness. And so in this scene, she's on the corner. She's dancing, which is like mm-hmm. the main thing she does, listen to her Walkman and dance around on the corner. And a guy asks her how much.
Right.
How about you do this to him, us? How much?
Hey, baby, what's your problem?
Just because a girl like to dress fancy and stand on the street corner near some whores, you automatically think she's hooking?
Would you?
I would.
Just likes to stand on the corner.
Yeah.
And, you know, dress fancy. Hang out with the whores. That's just their thing. What's wrong with that?
One of the things that's so great to me about Pootie Tang, I mean, besides just this, it's just one of the funniest things, albeit a little bit of a mess, but a lot of a mess, but real funny. And one of the things that's really great about it, it's something that I've talked with Chris Rock and grew out of the Chris Rock show and talked with Louis C.K., who directed it, is that it's rare that you get to see a comedy that is mostly African-American performers where they are being really silly.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's when have you seen like a like black Monty Python? Not saying that we were Python at all, but yeah, I think that was the beauty of it. It's just stepping out of the norm, you know. Just why can't we be silly?
No, I mean, I think it's, you know, if you want to talk about what white privilege is, you know, one of the big things is that you get to step out of the norm because there's just a lot of white people. And, you know, when you're the main voice, you can be an alternative voice. And when you're fundamentally an alternative voice, because there's just a lot less people whose skin is your color, then you don't get to do that.
Exactly.
Or it's a lot harder to get to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're black and you're doing comedy, you better just be damn funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, well, can I explore this? Nope. Stay in this lane.
But the thing that I love about Biggie Shorty, as with Pootie Tang, but it is the self-possession that she has is so extreme.
Oh, yeah.
It must have been just a thrill to get to do.
God, that was so much fun. Yeah. I mean, she has such conviction and like, she owned that. She owned it. And that was so much fun doing that. Like, it's just great to just walk in a room and go, I'm right. I am right. And there's nothing that you can say that will make me think otherwise. What a feeling.
Wanda Sykes, I so appreciate you taking the time to be on Bullseye.
Thanks for having me.
Genuine honor to have you on the show. So
I
admire your work.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Wanda Sykes. If you live in L.A., you can see her performing at the theater at the Ace Hotel this Saturday, the 21st. She's filming for her epic special, which will be out later this year. It's called What Happened, Miss Sykes? She's also out on tour this spring and summer. Details are at wandasykes.com. Sadate, Wanda. Every week we like to close the show with a recommendation from me, your host. It's The Outshot. I once tried to book an interview with the band Black Moth Super Rainbow. I actually didn't specify which members of the band. The leader's name is Tobacco. Other members have included a person named Pony Diver, one called the Seven Fields of Aphelion, someone known as Power Pill Fist, and a keyboardist who goes by Father Hummingbird. The publicist at the time told me that they were honored to be asked, but nonetheless declined. They didn't want to talk about themselves. It would ruin it. The album I got in the mail was called Eating Us. It was actually kind of a play for respectability, produced by a guy who'd helped the Flaming Lips make hits. But it still sounds like the soundtrack to a movie about the highest heck religious rites of some race of people from the center of the earth.
I'm
doesn't sound like a band. It feels like it was written and recorded by a purple gas oozing through the cracks in the walls of a prison cell on Mars. Black Moth Super Rainbow is both meditative and slightly discomforting, beautiful and a little scary. Someone singing a lullaby from the other side. There was a reason they didn't do the interview. Maybe explaining Black Moth Super Rainbow really does ruin it. So, I say just listen. That's my outshot. We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Abadia Nexperello. Our production assistant, Christian Duenas. Senior producer is Colin Anderson. Special thanks to Jennifer Marmer, who's been helping out. All our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Our thanks to the Go team and their label Memphis Industries for our theme music. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows and extended versions of many of our interviews, all of them are free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. Help to make Bullseye even better by taking a quick survey. Just go to npr.org/bullseyesurvey and tell us what you think. That's npr.org/bullseyesurvey. Thank you. Our outgoing producer this week, her last week, is Julia Smith. Julia's been working with us since I was just a guy in an apartment in Silver Lake. She is our first real producer, and so grateful to her for all these years of help. So she's on to greener pastures, and we wish her all the best, but we're very grateful for all the hard work that she's put in. Thank you, Julia. And I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. Your social battery is precious, so make sure you're using it the way you want to. Therapy can help you figure out your social sweet spot. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at RosettaStone.com/NPR.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.